Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. 2 weeks ago, I spoke to Professor Tom Keck about Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh's Senate confirmation hearings. Well, a lot can change in 2 weeks. Since then, we've learned that Christine Blasey Ford alleges that Brett Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her at a party more than 30 years ago when they were both in high school. In July, she wrote a letter to California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein alerting her to the incident. Blasey Ford has since gone public and shared the details of the allegations with the Washington Post. Kavanaugh's vote has now been delayed until the Senate Judiciary Committee can hear from and question both Blasey Ford and Kavanaugh. But how that will happen and what role the FBI will play are uncertain at this point. The conversation that you're about to hear is taking place on Thursday morning. I have two guests with me today to help us reconsider the Kavanaugh confirmation in light of these developments. Professor Tom Keck rejoins me. He holds the Michael Sawyer Chair of Constitutional Law and Politics at Syracuse University's Maxwell School. He's the author of The Most Activist Supreme Court in History and Judicial Politics in Polarized Times. He's joined by Professor Shana Guderian, also from Syracuse University's Maxwell School. She writes on American politics and public opinion and is the co-author of Anxious Politics, Democratic Citizenship in a Threatening World. Tom, Shana, welcome to the program, and welcome back, Tom.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with you. Let's just start with a look to the past. Almost immediately after this story broke, comparisons with Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas were made. So I'm wondering, does the benefit of hindsight on that event, and in particular the way that Anita Hill was viewed and treated at the time, and including, I should say, by Democrats and including Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Joe Biden at the time. Does that help shape and influence the way this case is being viewed?
Sure. Well, that's a great starting point. For some of our younger listeners, let me just say briefly that in 1991, President Bush, the first President Bush, nominated Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court. The Senate Judiciary Committee conducted a more or less conventional round of hearings, and it then came out that a former staffer who had worked at two different government agencies for Clarence Thomas had accused him of multiple ongoing acts of sexual harassment in the workplace. And as you indicated, the Senate Judiciary, which was all male at the time and chaired by Senator Biden, scheduled a second round of hearings at which the widespread impression certainly among many women who were watching, but I think among many men as well, was that they put Anita Hill on trial, not Clarence Thomas, right? And the all-male Judiciary Committee was widely criticized for its treatment of Hill in that open hearing. And so, as you say, immediately upon the revelation of these most recent allegations against Kavanaugh, comparisons were brought back to that earlier episode, and lots of folks were wondering, can the Senate Judiciary Committee do a better job this time of investigating what appear to be credible allegations and doing so in a way that respects the rights of the victim?
And Shana, on this same issue, I'm wondering whether this moment then might be seen as providing some way to close the circle on that earlier event, that it in itself may provide its own set of motivations for observers and for some of the senators involved?
Well, certainly there are some of the same senators involved now that were in 1991. Are we going to get any better treatment of Christine Blasey Ford? I think that's an open question. And Anita Hill actually wrote an op-ed asking for let's try and do better than in 1991. And I think again, there are more women involved in the process now, but certainly not on the majority side. There are no Republican women who serve on the Judiciary Committee. And I think there is a concern both from the members themselves and from the larger public that this is, again, going to be a spectacle where Blasey Ford is going to be on trial and her background and her motivations are going to be questioned as they are in the mass media right now, rather than investigations of these particular allegations themselves.
And then, of course, you know, there's the Me Too movement, and
sure,
this is happening kind of after that and still in the middle of it. So How do you think, in just in terms of the politics, that plays out and is being viewed?
So I think there's two things going on. There's one is the actual allegations and how we think about those allegations in this particular process of the Kavanaugh confirmation. And then there's the broader politics of Me Too right now, which are both recognizing and trying to maybe do better in the way in which both society and the workplace treat women. So there's a lot of sense of support in kind of the broader public among women activists of Blasey Ford on this kind of broader sense that women have to be believed and we have to respect their place in society and not think of them as less than men. So I think this is all happening at the same time.
Tom, what's your take on that, how the Me Too movement might be affecting some of the politics of this and the way it's being viewed?
Well, I'll say my initial reaction when Christine Blasey Ford first went public was sort of how you framed it in the question, like, oh, this is a given the current moment that we're in, right, given the Me Too movement, the Senate Judiciary Committee can't possibly get away with treating her the way they treated Anita Hill. And so wouldn't it be nice if this is a, you know, if these two like historical events are remembered together as a sign of some significant progress, right? In the days that have followed, I'm not sure how optimistic I am that anything better is going to happen, right? You know, there's reports that Blasey Ford has been receiving death threats and her email has been hacked. She and her family have had to move out of their home. Many Republican operatives, including some sitting senators, have made comments that have been extraordinarily dismissive of her very detailed and, I have to say, highly credible allegations. So all of those things
kind of demonstrating why she was reluctant to
come forward in the first place. Sure.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Maxwell School professors Tom Keck and Shayna Guderian, and we're discussing the Kavanaugh Supreme Court hearings. Tom, let me stick with you. Is it – okay, so there's that context. Now, another context for this is, of course, the level of political polarization in the country and the strong partisanship that exists. So is it possible even to analyze what's happening right now and what will happen without the lens of – partisanship? And I'm thinking, is this something perhaps that could tap social issues in a way that might break through or explode that for a change?
Well, so Congress is extraordinarily polarized. The Senate is extraordinarily polarized. The Senate Judiciary Committee is extraordinarily polarized. And the Supreme Court is increasingly polarized, right? Which really raises the stakes for this nomination. Kavanaugh's nomination from the beginning has been widely perceived as an opportunity for the Republicans to finally cement their firm control of the Supreme Court, which they've been seeking for a long time. And so given the high level of polarization and the high stakes for this nomination, I think that explains the behavior of some of the Republican senators, right? So Lindsey Graham's been extraordinarily dismissive of Blasey Ford's accusations, for example, and said that it is imperative that we stay on schedule and move forward with this vote. And so to your question, I don't know whether, you know, so is it possible that, for example, some Republican women would be turned off of their party's treatment of Blasey Ford in this situation? I think that is possible, but I don't know yet whether that's happening. So it might just be a, you know, sort of reinscribing the polarization that we already have.
I want to, a little bit later, talk about how this might impact some future political events, including the midterms. But Shayna, you've studied how polarization intersects with then messaging and different kinds of messaging. So is there any hope for me in the idea that somehow this might be a moment that breaks through that?
No.
Thanks.
So I'm not particularly optimistic. So one thing I want to back up and say is not only is the polarization increasingly obvious at the institutional level, it is also increasingly obvious among people who pay attention at the mass level. So So one thing I want to say is most people are not paying close attention in the mass public or not paying close attention to the confirmation hearing. But one of the things that could get people to pay attention is an issue like sexual harassment, sexual assault, because one, it's easy to understand, and two, it's going to get covered very extensively when these confirmation hearings come back. It is going to be much more of a spectacle than, say, your normal kind of confirmation hearing. So one of the things that's pretty obvious is that lots of people say they don't know how they feel about Brett Kavanaugh because they're not paying very close attention. Among the people who do pay attention, it's pretty split along partisan lines about whether or not they think he should be confirmed. And that is informing their views about whether or not Blasey Ford is credible and whether or not they should hear from her. So there's two things. One is that that means that those people aren't going to be movable by whatever she says unless there's more evidence brought to bear, perhaps by the FBI, perhaps by the Senate Judiciary. But that also that there is this big portion, almost 25% to 30% of people who could be moved to form an opinion and perhaps move toward one side or another based on the evidence, but only if they are paying attention. And that is partially why the Republicans want to move this through so quickly, is they would rather not have more evidence. They would rather not people who are not paying attention start to kind of put on their lenses and pay attention, because if more things come out that are not particularly positive toward their nominee, it could take those people who aren't paying attention and move them into putting pressure to withdraw the nomination.
And Tom, I'll just be honest here about sort of my initial reactions. When I first read this and read some of the things that suggested that this was, you say, you know, credible accusations, I mean, that need to be taken very seriously, my first thought was, well, this is done. This is over. They're going to have to get another nominee. But a lot of observers of the Supreme Court, and I would include Nina Totenberg speaking on NPR the other day, have opined that Kavanaugh is still likely to be confirmed. So what's your read of the likely outcome at this point?
Well, things change day by day. So, but at this moment, yes, if I had to bet, I would say he's likely to be confirmed. It's a long-term, deeply rooted goal of the Republican Party, right, to capture control of the Supreme Court, and they think this is their moment, and the moment is closing, right? So if Kavanaugh's nomination is pulled, there's lots of other well-qualified conservative judges who President Trump could replace him with. But given the timing, they would not be able to confirm that second-choice nominee before the midterms. They might well be able to do so during the lame duck session in December, I think would then be the goal. But that window is going to close, right, if they're not able to move quickly. So there's plenty of other choices who would be almost as good or just as good from their side, but they might run out of time to get such a person confirmed.
I want to explore that in more detail in a minute. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Professor Shana Guderian and Professor Tom Keck. We're discussing the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearings in light of the allegations of sexual assault by Christine Blasey Ford. Okay, before the break, we were talking about the midterms, and I want to think about that a little bit more. Tom, you mentioned how the midterm elections seem to be playing into the thinking of the Republicans about whether to go forward, whether to delay the vote. What about the Democrats as well? And also, what about the idea of withdrawing this nomination entirely, given where we are now, and trying to start over quickly? How does the timing all work in their minds this way?
Well, I mean, the timing it. The odds are that Republicans will maintain control of the Senate in this year's midterms, but that is not guaranteed. And the Democrats have a chance of flipping enough seats to take control of the chamber, in which case, given the Republican Senate's treatment of President Obama's last Supreme Court nominee, I think it is highly likely that the Democrats would not confirm any Trump nominee to the Supreme Court. Right. So because we don't know the election outcome yet, Republicans have a short window in which they know that they have majority control and can confirm a Trump Supreme Court nominee. And so they could do it before the midterms, but I don't think there's time, right? Once the nominee is announced, there's a vetting process they have to go through. They can try to cut corners. They can try to rush it, but they can't abandon all pretense of Senate rules. I think at the moment they probably would have time to confirm that nominee in December. The election, of course, is November 6th, but the current Congress stays in office until the beginning of January, and so they could well. My assumption is that that would be Plan B. If Kavanaugh has to get pulled, they would want it to happen pretty soon so they could move on to Plan B, and then they would confirm somebody else in December. But I think they remain focused on Plan A, which is to confirm Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court.
Shana, I think you had some thoughts about this lame duck strategy as plan B, but how do you see this?
So it sounds like, I mean, that's all possible given the kind of current politics, but the other current politics is a very energized and angry public who is putting pressure on the committee right now and would put a great deal of pressure on this committee even after the midterms, particularly. I mean, what we're seeing, we don't know what the election outcome is, but it's quite likely the Democrats take back the House for sure, and that the Senate is unclear, and Republicans probably will keep control. But I think the public is going to see a Congress that they want, which would be more balanced and more Democratic, and then see this lame duck session as an affront to what they just did and just said in the midterm elections. Now, they don't have a lot of recourse other than more protests, more calling, more putting pressure on these members, some of whom might have just lost their jobs. And so maybe they bow to public pressure, maybe they don't.
Can I flip this around, though? I mean, there's another way to think about this is if they do go through with this confirmation, perhaps more quickly than the Democrats are saying it should be done, doesn't that perhaps also hurt the Republicans in the midterms?
Absolutely.
If they go ahead and confirm Kavanaugh, couldn't that be kind of a cause celebre for the Democrats?
I think so. The only way I can explain the current treatment of Professor Blasey Ford by the Republican leadership in the Senate in political terms, like what are they thinking? The only way I can currently explain that is that their prospects in the midterms are already so bad and can hardly get worse, right? That they're banking on that there's going to be an enormous gender gap this November. They're going to lose a lot of suburban women votes. That's already baked in. And so this is their chance to get their guy on the court. Regardless of what happens in the elections, he gets to be on the court for 30 years. And so there's some political costs. We're already paying those political costs.
Is that your take, Shana?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, I think they're already seeing that the losses are going to be pretty major. And so but I think there's another thing here, which is what we haven't mentioned is that this party is now the party of Donald Trump, who has been accused of harassment and assault of multiple women. And if you have now put your stock in a party of Donald Trump, you have said to the voters in your party that sexual assault is not a big deal. It is not an issue that will keep you out of power. And so given that there hasn't been a lot of criticism, at least publicly, of Donald Trump on those allegations from the party, it's hard to say how you walk that back and say, well, we're going to hold this other person to a different standard.
Let me ask you a follow-up on that. And this is a difficult question in some ways, but I feel like I need to ask it here, given the way that you frame this. One of the things, though, that I am reading is, well, this has happened a long time ago. They were both in high school, this kind of thing. And how then, and going back to the Anita Hill comparisons, where that was not so far in the past, ongoing and in a professional workplace, how does that play out here, do you think?
Well, one, we only know of one credible allegation. That does not mean that there aren't more, possibly. And I do think we have, one, a sense that people can be redeemed and they can ask for forgiveness. We haven't seen any of that here. So there's denial, which, again, may be real, may be a political tactic.
Has Brett Kavanaugh, what is the level of denial at this point? Has he saying, I wasn't in this house, I wasn't at this party, or I have never done anything to this woman or any other woman?
I think it was, I don't remember this incident.
There's been multiple statements. The direct statements from Kavanaugh himself have said, it never happened, I never did anything like that to her or anyone. But then there's been several confusing statements from other members on the Republican side, including Orrin Hatch, who said he just got off the phone with Kavanaugh and he told me he doesn't think he was at that party in question,
okay,
which is just a confusing form of denial because there's not even enough details have been publicly shared about the party for anyone to credibly say that they weren't there at some specific party on an unnamed date 30 years ago. And one other thing I would just add here is that Kavanaugh faces credible allegations of having committed multiple felonies, some of which have no statute of limitations in the state of Maryland. It's a long time ago, right? No investigation has been conducted. Maybe prosecutors would conclude these things couldn't currently be prosecuted. But that decision is a decision that would be made by prosecutors after an investigation. And Republicans are trying to confirm the guy to the Supreme Court for a lifetime appointment before any such investigation takes place. Among other things, this is going to have a potentially significant negative impact on the just public respect and legitimacy for the Supreme Court, right, if they push him through without any investigation at all.
And I'll say this will be a particular problem because it's quite likely that challenges to Roe v. Wade come up in the next several years. And if Kavanaugh is on the court with a Clarence Thomas in a court that is going to restrict the health options of women, this is going to be a problem for the legitimacy of the court as an institution.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guests are Maxwell School professors Tom Keck and Shana Guderian. You've been reading my mind with these last two points because this is exactly where I wanted to finish this conversation. So one of them that occurs to me is, Tom, you mentioned the way the Supreme Court is viewed, and Shana, you were talking about that. So let's imagine that he is confirmed, okay? Let's just, whether it's in a lame duck session or in the regular session. First of all, what effect is this going to have on the way that Kavanaugh is viewed from here on out, Kavanaugh himself? Because certainly Clarence Thomas carries this baggage with him to this day.
Clarence Thomas for sure carries the baggage. On the other hand, given lifetime appointments, right, a lot of time can pass, and Clarence Thomas gets to go about his business being a Supreme Court justice, and most of the time, folks are not – most days that he's doing that work, most folks are not asking him about Anita Hill. So time will pass on the one hand, and Kavanaugh will be a Supreme Court justice likely for decades. On the other hand, I think Shana's right that the combination of being on the court with Clarence Thomas and having been appointed by a president who himself faces multiple credible allegations of sexual assault, right, and the fact that this confirmation was pushed through without any credible investigation being conducted, those I think those facts can be expected to damage the public's impression of the Supreme Court, particularly among Democrats and particularly among women, but more broadly as well, potentially.
And Shana, you mentioned particular cases that might come before the court, and that struck me too. And it wasn't clear to me in my thinking how it might affect Kavanaugh's decision making in this way. I mean, how do you see it potentially influencing if he's got a case about women's rights in front of him or reproductive rights, how he thinks about this if he's on the court, but he's gone through this process and has this baggage that he's carrying?
I mean, I can't speak to how he'll decide in the future. I know what we know, that he is on the side of more restrictions for women's reproductive rights. And so I can't imagine that changing very much, particularly if the process is quick and dismissive of Blasey Ford. I'm not particularly optimistic that someone's kind of legal theories change very much based on a process that looks like it's not taking a woman's perspective particularly seriously.
I was thinking perhaps of, and again, you're right, you know, it's hard to get inside someone's head and predict what they're going to do in the future in terms of this decision making. But if he is on the court and he's a smart guy and he's aware that, you know, his legitimacy has been damaged, Tom, is there any, you've looked at how justices think and make decisions. I thought perhaps this might make him, in a sense, move a little bit more to the center or the left on some of these decisions, knowing that, you know, he's got this rep, he's got the street rep, so to speak.
That's pretty speculative, and
yes.
It didn't happen with Clarence Thomas. So, the other psychological alternative, right, is to dig in, right, which I think is probably what Clarence Thomas did. The court insiders have always said that Thomas has maintained an extraordinary level of bitterness about the way he was treated, in his mind, the way he was treated by the Senate. Supposedly, I don't have any firsthand knowledge of this, but I have heard the story told that in his desk in his chambers at the Supreme Court, he has a piece of paper with the roll call vote on his confirmation, which was 52-48. And he's got the list of the 48 senators who voted against him in his desk drawer, supposedly. So that kind of thing is also a possible long-term impact on the way the judge is approaching these questions.
We've got a couple minutes left, but I want to think about the other alternative. Okay, so let's say that this does sink his nomination, all right, whether it's by timing or just the issue itself. So, Tom, you mentioned earlier that you would expect if the Senate goes Democratic that they won't take up anybody, but let's say that the Senate stays Republican, which I think is still kind of the odds-on likely outcome. So now President Trump is going to nominate somebody else. Who is he going to nominate in his place? I'm thinking of one of the senators on the Judiciary Committee. I think it was Lindsey Graham kind of making a joke with Kavanaugh on the first day, like, I'm glad it's you in front of me. I was kind of worried who I was going to see here. So who are we going to see here, do you think?
So in these circumstances, someone with good political instincts would nominate a conservative woman in the place of Kavanaugh. Trump is not someone who has your kind of normal political instincts because he is someone who actually does double down and dig in when challenged. And so my guess is if Kavanaugh gets pulled, you get someone who looks very much like Kavanaugh, a white man who's quite conservative, who is probably on the appeals court right now. I'm less knowledgeable than Tom is about who that might be. But there are conservative women judges who he could pick. But my guess would, if under pressure, Trump might nominate a conservative woman, but that wouldn't be his normal political instinct.
Tom, what's your take of this? I mean, my thought, perhaps he might go even he would go further to the right. He would take one of these people that Lindsey Graham was, quote unquote, worried about seeing, whoever that was.
So with Trump, who knows, right? But I would say that so far to date, Trump's judicial appointment strategy has been the most conventional, one of the most conventional parts of his presidency, right? He has appointed judges, not just to the Supreme Court, but to the lower courts as well, who to a significant extent are like the judges that other Republican presidents appoint, with a couple outliers, a couple pretty extreme ones to the lower courts. So I think his allies in the Senate would encourage him to nominate somebody that could get confirmed. And that might be a conservative woman, but we don't know for sure.
That was Shana Guderian and Tom Keck. Shana, Tom, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thanks, Grant.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.